Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. Nothing more positive than having our former mayor, former governor, and doing it. And by the time we're done, you will have a Fadley's crab cake here.
All right. Good.
Don Moeller here. We want to give a shout out to Jennings and State Fair, and of course, our friends here at Fadley's, as well as Center Management. We spent a little time in Annapolis. I got a little bit of your adopted hometown
down
there.
We were down there yesterday doing Hospital Association.
So you'll get that out of Baltimore Positive, too.
Issues. We can get into that.
Yeah, Annapolis is a chocolate box of the town. It's my favorite phrase about Annapolis, and my family and I were honored and privileged to have lived there for 8 years. But my favorite phrase about Annapolis is that it's a drinking town with a sailing problem.
Bring in the music. That's what I'm saying.
We want to thank our sponsors at Fadley's, Jennings, State Fair, Center Maryland. They make this happen. They bring smart people to us. If you're sitting at home, you need a book. Smarter Government. As I said earlier, I don't care if you're a Democrat, Republican, Independent. This is a book about how to make government work, something I think we all want to happen.
This is your favorite conversation, isn't it? I mean, you
talking
said something very
government.
Nice to us when we got
talking about
because
government.
You eat and breathe.
You
this.
Love
this
government.
It was that conversation we just had about public safety
right.
was the most one. About the most intelligent conversation I've had about public safety and fact-based.
Well, thank you. Well, go back.
Since leaving office.
If you're listening, go back. That's the previous episode. Check it out. I want to start, Governor, and I was telling Nestor before you arrived, he and I were debating some of the issues and certainly some of the big issues you attacked as Governor. But I said I always knew, I don't know if I knew it intuitively, I don't remember if you and I chatted about it, but I said, so many folks that come on, who we are, one of our premises is who we are as adults, really formed by who we were as little kids, what we learned around the dinner table. And my sense always was that your faith, you don't wear it on your sleeve, but that your faith, your Catholicism, is really a part of who you are. And I thought the Washington Post really characterized it when they said, here's what you need to know about Martin O'Malley. He's a pray every morning, church every Sunday, believer.
The Washington they get it right? Post said that about
yeah.
me?
Yeah.
See,
they get
read
it? Do they get it right? Are you a pray every morning, church every Sunday guy?
Yeah, pretty much. I'll tell you, some mornings I miss, but and I pay for it later in the day because it's not as good a day. Yeah.
Tell us about then, because I think what people are interested in, and I think particularly of your, you took criticism at time, over it. Nestor and I probably disagree on the issue. The issue of capital punishment. I always had a sense that your position on capital punishment was truly based in your faith and the teachings of your faith. Am I right or wrong about that? And if I'm wrong, correct me.
Yeah, well, no, I think you're entirely right. And you might say that about all of my public policy positions.
Walk us through that then.
Not that I'm infallible and not that I always make the right decisions, but having been raised in a family where, it's about love your family, love God, and love your country. I can't really separate my faith from the conclusions my brain took me to.
What your justice is,
policy.
Right? Or what your
at least it's my take. And I remember talking to Bobby Zirkin actually about this issue.
Our guest
of
next
the
week.
Death penalty.
Hey, Bobby's coming on to talk about his next phase
and,
of life.
And Bobby said to me on the death penalty, he said, I almost envy those of you that have a really clear opinion on this because I could kind of go either way.
Right.
I see the arguments both ways. And Bobby's a really good person.
Right.
And people that were for the death penalty, a lot of the families that I've worked with on that and spoke to had lost loved ones in some really horrible crimes. So let me come up to answer your question, though, to a higher level. Certainly my opposition to the death penalty was based on faith. But my conclusion on that as to a public policy had a lot of other inputs as well. Yeah, so Don, to take it to a higher level and to go back to the call of your question, yes, my opposition to the death penalty was based on my faith, but my conclusion as to what's best for all of us as Marylanders of different faiths and different, and some of us professing no faith, was informed by some other considerations and other analysis, like does it work or does it not? Does the death penalty really save lives? If we find things that save lives, we should probably do more of them and do them at a higher scale.
Is there something on that where you would get data where you really believe the data? Like that would be the hardest thing for me on something like that, where you say, is it really saving lives or isn't it? And let's study it. I would always be a little skeptical of using that as a reasoning for whether it works or not.
No, that's a big part of the reasoning. I mean, I believe the government, Democratic government anyway, is a longitudinal experiment. We figure out over the course of time what works. We learn from our successes and our mistakes, and we try to do more of the things that work more effectively and less of the things that don't or that are unjust. The death penalty does not work, is not a deterrent.
I'm not challenging that. I just want to hear your belief on that.
Because when we had it, crime actually went up. And when we didn't have it, which essentially we didn't, our Court of Appeals struck it down, we nonetheless were doing other things that did work. And without the death penalty, we were able to save lives. And but it goes to other, there's other pieces of the analysis as well, and that has to do with, you know, what sort of world and what sort of country do we want to give to our kids? The six countries that account for the vast majority of the world's executions are communist China, Iraq, Afghanistan,
probably the Philippines, right?
Yemen, the United States of America. I don't want my kids' country in their company. Right. You know, the Cardinal of Washington came to see me just to kind of check in, and he said, as he sat down, he said, you know, I just wanted to talk with you. And he said, as a cardinal of my faith, he said, my job is relatively simple compared to yours. He said, I have a 2,000-year-old text, and it's relatively simple. He said, you have a much tougher job. You have to, and he put his hands around, like, pointing at the various things on the walls of a governor's office. He said, you have to be concerned about a lot of different things, and you have to represent people of all faiths. And he said, you have a much more complex and complicated job than I do. I tried, Don, to do my very best, knowing that the only reward was that I could look myself in the mirror when my wife and I left that service and say, hey, we did our very best, and we made the decisions we made based on what we thought was best for the people of our state. I wasn't infallible, probably made some mistakes in hindsight, tried to correct them as soon as it became apparent I made the wrong decision. But as you know, that's the only reward you really have when you leave office, is knowing you did your very best for the right reasons.
So interesting, Governor. Your good friend, my former boss and good friend, Jim Smith, the owner of the red hot phone in Baltimore County after after the first election. I had been with Jim, and it goes so much to your point, I had been with him about a month back, I guess, right in the beginning of 2002. And I came home one night and I said to my wife, I said, it's really interesting. I didn't know Jim well. People assumed we knew each other forever. We became close friends, but we did not. Sort of like you and Gallagher. Everybody assumes you and Gallagher knew one another forever. You did not.
Yeah, he told us that story.
Matt said, no, I didn't, until I came down from Ed Rendell, and then we got to know each other.
Yeah, he came here after the battle.
Right.
He came here to walk through the Arch Day Triumph. Now, Matt was awesome. I hope he runs for mayor.
He was great. So Jim said, I said to my wife, I said to Linda, you know, it's interesting. There have been two or three times in this first month where Jim was presented with a door one and a door two. Both are fine options. I said, door one was more of the right thing to do. Door two was okay to do and probably more expedient. And I said, Jim chose door one every time.
Yeah, that's
so
good.
I went into him one day and I said, you got to walk me through this. I'm kind of new to the political thing. I said, you've chosen door one. And I want to see if you agree with what he said. He said, Don, here's what I've learned in my years in politics. If you go to bed at night having done the right thing, the politics will take care of itself.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of wisdom, a lot of practical wisdom. Governor Rendell said the same thing to me in a different sort of way. He said, two bits of advice. One, surround yourself with the smartest people you can possibly
find. You did that.
Thank you. Like Matt Gallagher and
Michael Enright and the Kevin Loebs of the world. You had a team.
And the second advice he gave me was, make every decision as if you're not running for re-election.
Yes. Yes. Amen.
He said, and what you'll find is not only will your batting average for making the right decision for your people go up, but even when people disagree with you on decisions, they'll at least appreciate that's why you're making
your
them.
Your spine
which
doesn't
is the
bend,
best,
right? Literally.
Which is the best politics of all. And I do think people intuitively, you know, are generally smarter than perhaps our current politics would indicate.
Well, I was telling Nestor also before you arrived. I said, boy, when you go back, and we lived through it. I said, but when you go back and look at the governor or look at the mayor's election results, I said, there's something about this guy O'Malley. He knows how to win elections.
Hey, you won. Even Mike Miller admitted that once.
I mean, you won tough. You weren't supposed to win. First of all, back in the beginning, you run against Johnny Pica in a state Senate district, 44, I think, right. If I remember. You lose by
43rd district.
Right. You lose by 44 votes, goes to absentee ballots. You weren't supposed to win at all. And then you come back and you win city council. And I still remember when you run for mayor, you're standing out on that corner. Lawrence Bell's well known. Carl Stokes is well known. And you go through that whole, there's more than unites us. We're better than this. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be dying. And you come out of nowhere and you win that race, and the rest is history. People forget that in, I call it O'Malley-Ehrlich 2, you got almost 57% of the vote.
Twice the margin of the first time.
Right.
Neither time was easy. Ehrlich was a very formidable opponent, raised a lot of money the second time. One of the things I find very gratifying, encouraging, little reported, is that my margins from my black neighbors in the most humble neighborhoods of Baltimore went up higher and higher in every single election I ever ran, I don't often use the word pride or proud, but I know that that would make my ancestors proud.
Well, I think you should be proud. I want to jump back to the book, because there are a couple, there's so much in the book. Again, we're talking Smarter Government, available in bookstores on Amazon.
Hey, that's my book. You got
terrific
your books over
book.
There.
Nestor has his. There are a couple of stories that I think really illustrate making government work. The first is your young mayor. It's on the end. Boom. Howard Street Tunnel. Howard Street Tunnel.
Can we move that chapter up?
Okay. Well, I mean, it's a compelling chapter. For folks who don't know who are listening, we're with Governor Martin.
And O'Malley. I don't know this story.
It was a big emergency.
Remind folks about where you were, how you found out, and then what you
fire?
Had to do.
Oh, yes.
Governor
will
tell you.
So,
okay.
Don, feel free to fast forward me through this. So it was in July of, I guess, what was it? 2001. Yeah, I was on the Eastern Shore at that annual thing that every county executive and governor has
100 degrees.
Chrisfield.
Let me guess.
That's
Chrisfield
Seafood Festival.
Nice. Yeah, Miller Todd.
It was nice.
Hello, Anita McCoola, my dog high friend who lives at Chrisfield.
So. I love the Eastern Shore. Beautiful place. Been going there since I was a boy.
Get the best corn there.
And so I was on the way back from there, and I get a call from Michael Enright, and he says, hey, we've had a train wreck here in Baltimore. I said, I knew they were going to screw up that library closure
metaphorically
conference.
Right.
And Enright says, no, like a real train
like a
wreck.
A real one.
I said, where? And he said, somewhere under the city. I said, what do you mean somewhere under the city? He said, well, apparently there's a big long tunnel that runs from Camden Yards up to where the symphony, where the BSO plays, and there's a fire right now somewhere in that tunnel. Smoke's billowing out. There's a doubleheader going on, and it's just early. Turn on your radio.
So, and you've been mayor how long?
I was mayor just about a year and 6 months.
About a year, 18 months.
Yeah, I hadn't had a big emergency. I'd gone on ride-alongs with police and certainly, you know, heard about four alarms, but hadn't had a big emergency like that. So he said, turn on the radio. So I turn on the radio. I'm listening to WBAL. WBAL says people are fleeing the doubleheader. An air raid siren starts to go off, and I thought to myself, how did that happen without anybody checking with me? But then again, I'm glad somebody's making decisions when I'm caught in the middle of a cornfield in, you know, Dorchester County. So by the time I got back, the city had cleared out. There was a thin smoke all over the place. The fire was still burning. It ruptured a water main, which broke the intersection of Howard and, what was it, Lombard there? Ever forget? So light rail was disrupted. And worse, all of the water pressure to put out the fire went down because this giant old water main blew up. It cut off water for all of downtown. And meanwhile, by the way, we now get word that there are certain lethal chemicals as part of that train, and we don't know how close the fire is to those lethal chemicals. So it might become important and necessary to evacuate lots of people.
They make movies about this stuff, right?
So the 37-year-old mayor?
Yeah, I was a
37-year-old mayor puts the crabs down and says, let's go home.
Yeah, well, actually, I was already on the road.
I was already back on the road.
But I said to the police officer, go faster. Right. And probably one of the few times I ever used lights and sirens.
Right. So tell us why. And I think, again, Nestor's somebody who often thinks about public service, maybe running.
Well, crisis management,
and
too.
Crisis management. Walk us through. Really soup to nuts, and you said fast forward you. I really don't want to fast forward you, because I want people to hear what a 37-year-old mayor thinks, and then what you put into action, and then what are the after-action takeaways?
Yeah, there were a lot of lessons that I learned, and the reason we moved that chapter up in the book was because of the suspense and because of, you know, my inexperience and the lessons that I had to learn on the job of a big emergency management.
Did you know it was there? Did you?
I had no idea that tunnel was there.
Okay, fair enough.
I didn't even know it was there. And I got news for you. It took us a long time to figure out how to get there.
How much did you learn after you were mayor that you could not have possibly known when you
ran?
All sorts of minutia. We could go on for hours on that. But
it's like being a football fan and then being a football coach.
It took the fire department a long time to figure out how to get in on the part of the tunnel that where the blaze was actually
happening.
Well,
they had never seen anything like this.
So what are you saying? And all of the plans were on paper, and they were all...
So what are you saying to Enright on the way back? Michael, do this. What are the do thises?
Yeah, so my do this, I said, get everybody together. I'm going to be... You know, we have lights and sirens. We're making progress now. I said, as soon as I get there, I want to know, you know, what's happening where and when. So I had that instinct anyway going. And I said, have everybody meet us in the CompStat room in the fire department, in the police department. Huge mistake. Never have a fire emergency until your fire guys to come to the police.
Well, that's in the book.
That's in the book.
That's a takeaway, right?
That's a takeaway. And then it was a matter of Michael Enright was very good, because it's easy in an emergency, and we saw this happen here tragically. It's easy to lose track of time in an emergency. So Michael Enright was very good about saying, like, every half hour as we were getting updates and all of us trying to get our brains around situationally, what are we dealing with? And when will the manifest be here? And when will we know where the toxic cars are? And when will we know how far the fire's gone? When will we know from the health department how broadly to evacuate? When will that wire be tripped to say we need to evacuate now? All of those sorts of things can consume a lot of time, and it makes the clock spin faster. So Michael was very good every 30 or 40 minutes of saying, hey, Mayor, you haven't talked to the public now for an hour. Mayor, you haven't talked to the public for an hour and 15 minutes. So Michael
was... Now you could tweet.
Now you could tweet. Yeah. But Michael was very good about saying, we've got to keep informing the public, telling moms and dads what we know, where it's happening, what they should do about it. You know, those basic questions.
Control the message.
Yeah, the other thing I came to understand, when I saw a younger police, or younger fire commander on the fire ground, do one of those, with all due respect, sir, sort of commanding fire chief. He said, with all due respect, sir, and I could tell the younger officer was annoyed. He said, we need to establish a unified command.
And you talk about in the book, that was a learning moment for you, and the importance of unified command and control. Who's in charge? Tell folks what that...
That's a sort of a wartime effort, right?
Tell folks what that means.
Military people get this. They call it military people get this. A lot of times in civilian governments, we don't. So this is unified command. It's easiest to explain what happens when it doesn't exist.
What chapter in the book?
This is chapter 2.
Chapter 2 in the book.
In media res. For those of you that are literary people. So this is what happens when you don't have unified command. When you don't have unified command, the water department, seeing their water main break, will suddenly turn off all of the water that feeds that area. Why? Because they're looking at it just through the narrow standpoint of what are their protocols when a big water main breaks, or you turn off the water. Well, that would make sense, except for the fact that their fellow and the lead agency in this case of mitigating the disaster, the fire department, is pumping water through their hoses.
Actually needs some water.
actually needs some water.
Water works.
So without a unified command, The water department does what it does. Fire does what it does. Maybe your transportation people do what they do. But without an awareness of what is needed right now by that lead agency, and sometimes the lead agency will shift. It might be a fire incident at first and then become a policing incident. In this case, it was a fire incident. So Unified Command says that in a fire incident, the Unified Command is established by the fire commander, your fire chief. Yeah, he'll have somebody managing operations.
The fire's more important than the flood?
On the fire ground. Yeah, the fire's more important than the flood, exactly. And then what the role of the mayor becomes, or the chief executive, is to become the best deputy fire chief that fire chief ever had, to use his or her power to convene people in support of the chief and not allow them just to go do their own thing independently. Unified command, so that everybody understands situationally what's happening, where, and when, so that we can run plays. It's like a football game.
Well, the fire chief knows more about the fire than the mayor.
Yeah, although it's not as much a specialty thing as it is a play-calling thing.
Right. Offensive coordinators call the offense. Defense calls the defense.
Right.
But the coach doesn't call the offense. Yeah. The offensive coordinator calls the offense.
I don't know about you, and I don't know what's going to happen. No, I don't know what's going to happen in November. But I get a sense that should the Democrats win, somebody might be on the short list for Secretary of Homeland Security. I'm not going to ask you if that's a job you'd be interested in, but you certainly have prepared for that job. You know what that job's
about.
Yeah,
there was a time when I thought I could be good at that.
I think there are a lot of people that still think you could. I'm going to take you, only because of time, to another thing that took place on your watch. You talk in the book, and I love it, Team O'Malley. When one O'Malley runs the family rallies, your brother Patrick is running for city council in New York, and the whole family's in the car, Peter's driving, you guys are going up to campaign. And then something happens. Take us through that morning.
Yeah, that's that emergency management chapter as well. So it was everybody remembers that day. Sunny, bright, beautiful. Mom's in the back seat. Peter's driving. And I didn't bring, in those days, the police executive protection detail with me because I thought it would be unseemly to have them, you know, sitting
walking
in a car
through the streets of Queens
while I'm working the polls for
right,
my little brother.
Right, right.
I said, you guys don't need to come. I'm good. And so my little brother was driving. I never did that again after this day. This day was September 11th. And the executive protection calls and said, you might want to avoid downtown Manhattan on your way to Queens because something just came across the news where there's a fire in a tall building. And so the traffic will probably be pretty snarled.
You're driving through Jersey at this point?
Yeah, we're driving through Jersey. We're on the Jersey Turnpike. And I said, I said, what happened? He said, it looks like a little plane flew into a building, and so the traffic will be a sign. I said, okay, thanks. It's sad. Say a little Hail Mary silently. Further up at the rest stop, we pull over for a bio break and to get an egg sandwich and a coffee and get back on the road. And as we're standing there in line, I look up, and the pictures are there of the World Trade Center, the first tower. And I said to my little brother, that doesn't look like a little plane. I said, I wonder if the plane was carrying something if it were a little plane, because that's what we heard, maybe a Cessna or something. I said, that's a much... So anyway, we get back in the car, more questions than answers, and I turn on the radio just in time to hear the announcer say, a second plane, and it was a jetliner, has flown into the second tower. I look at my little brother. He looks at me. Neither of us say a word, but he immediately decelerates, almost slamming on the brakes to catch the emergency turnaround, and we start hauling ass back to Baltimore. And it was one of the worst feelings of my time. I had a few bad days as mayor. That was one of them. To have the feeling that another attack was going to happen. It could very well happen in your own city, as I'm listening to the Pentagon then on the radio, as I'm hearing reports about the plane going down to our west in
Somerset,
Pennsylvania.
Man.
And we're in the triangle.
I'm going to say, we're 40 miles from D.C.
Man. And then the phones go down because everybody's talking to everybody trying to figure out that nobody they love is in danger up in New York. So I couldn't communicate with City Hall. And eventually I got a call through just in time, and the police detail for Baltimore met me at the county line on 695 or someplace, and we zipped into town. But that was a creepy day.
I mean, this is a baptism. I'm thinking, again, you've been mayor for 18 months. You've got the Howard Street Tunnel. You've got September 11th, and all of a sudden, you're putting on your big boy pants.
Yeah, and we thought, there was national cameras in Baltimore for 5 days during that Howard Street Tunnel.
This is 2 months later, literally.
Yeah, and, we were getting rave reviews for how well we managed it, if they only knew. You know, in those early hours, they'd done a Harvard case study right away on it. But this was a scale of preparedness that none of us had been prepared for as mayors. Shortly that night, I remember pacing the veranda. Eddie Norris was inside watching the television, just saying over and over again, "I can't believe they took down the towers," you know, and he had a little brother who they hadn't found yet who worked in some of those downtown buildings. But I said to his deputy, I said, "We're going to become the most prepared big city in America, because when these guys come back around for the second attack, I want us on the list of the most prepared, not among the least."
So what did that mean? What did that mean, Mayor, as you took steps from that day? People always say there's a pre 9/11 world, and there's a post 9/11 world. So there was a pre 9/11 Baltimore, and there was a post 9/11 Baltimore. Walk us through what that meant when you said we're going to be the best prepared city we can be.
Yeah, well, we didn't exactly know, but that was the vision. So with the advice of former U.S. Senator Gary Hart from Colorado, who along with Warren Rudman had actually written a report that nobody read, that said the future security threat to the United States at the highest is not a nuclear attack, but terrorist attacks, and that Americans will die on American soil in greater numbers than any time since the War of 1812. That was like a couple years before these attacks. So Gary Hart said to me, when I spent the whole next day calling everyone I possibly could in Washington for some guidance, you know, White House liaison office, my own congressional people, no, but, and in frustration, I turned to Senator Hart, and he said, "Martin, why on earth would you be calling Washington for answers to this?"
It's a local issue for you.
Washington will be 40 years catching up with this, and you can't wait. Your instincts are right. You want your city to be among the best prepared. He said, "If I were you, I would assemble all of the smartest people you can from Johns Hopkins, from Aberdeen Proving Ground, from Fort Detrick, people that know about bio and chem and all these other scary things that we're all having to consider right now, and form your own Baltimore security cabinet and come up with a plan for the capacities you need that will make you objectively a much more prepared and the best prepared city in America, and then start taking the actions necessary to build up those capacities."
It's a fire alarm in elementary school, right? That's preparedness, right?
It's preparedness on a massive scale. And we also had to bring to the table BGE for the grid. We had to bring, you know, the CSX guys who we knew were lacking in some preparedness and information sharing. So in the book, I lay out in a sidebar the 12 capacities that we laid out: interoperable communications, coverage with bomb squads, you know, just like you would with ambulance or fire, intelligence sharing, taking our fusion center and turning it into a truly all hazards, all crimes, regular daily information sharing capacity. Because if you can't track down Mrs. Kaczynski when she goes missing in the middle of the night with Alzheimer's when she went out for milk, you're not going to track down the white paneled Al-Qaeda van that was fleeing a scene, you know? So we added, as governor, we added a 13th capacity, and that was cybersecurity, something we really didn't talk about, believe it or not, in the attacks.
It's only affected our whole country over the last few years, or literally, right?
But it was so brand new. That new awareness that there was a new domain beyond, you know, land, water, air, and space of cyber didn't really come upon us till governor. So that's what we did, and I'm very proud. We had made great strides on all of those, and you can never be prepared enough.
Right. Well, it's interesting. I know we have to go to a break, but you remember when we had Dutch on? Dutch was our very first guest. I always say to Dutch, "You're going to be one that's the very first." And we asked Dutch, it's interesting that the governor ends this segment talking about cyber. We said to Dutch, "What keeps you up at night, Dutch, as a congressman?" And Dutch said, "Cyber attacks." Mm-hmm. He didn't hesitate.
Right.
And it's a whole new world. So, again, great segment.
I don't want to take a break.
Oh, you don't?
But I'm
we
going
are.
To. No. We're going to take a break. I'm going to come back, and I got a topic that's off of this topic.
Okay, and I want to talk politics. I want to talk Chesapeake Bay.
All right.
I want to talk a little education. We are with Governor and Mayor Martin O'Malley. Terrific book. What's it called,
Smarter
Nestor?
Government, How to Govern for Results in the Information Age. We're Fadley Seafood. We're going to have a crab cake, I swear, before it's all over. Probably some sweet tea. Might get a bowl of soup before it's all over. We're Fadley's. I'm Nestor. He's done. We're Baltimore Positive, back for more with former Governor Martin O'Malley here at Fadley's.